The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Monday night episode of The Heretics Hour, one of the longest running continuous radio programs on the internet. It's November 26, 2012. I am Carolyn Yeager, and we are underway. You know, I have a strange sound in my earphones, which started as soon as I plugged in, and it's like just a hissing noise, which I've never had before. It's not from Skype, because I reconnected with, and that's, so it's just something, maybe these earphones are starting to go bad. You know, when I was on with John DeNugent, a few weeks ago, I had a kind of a clackering noise going on. Now I have this. This is better than that. So I can just ignore it. I don't think any of you are hearing it. If you do hear it, if you hear something, a hissing noise in the background, please send me an email and let me know. I was going to talk about my email. Well, just send it to CarolynYeager.com or CarolynYeager.net and let me know if you hear anything. Probably you don't. It's probably just for me. So let's continue here because so much is happening, while at the same time so much has slowed down almost to a crawl. It's a conundrum of sorts. But Thanksgiving has taken its toll, and now we're rolling toward Christmas. What is the mood of our people? Well, I think it's subdued and even possibly resembling something of a state of shock. If that is so, it's actually good. We could use a little bit of a shock. But if we wait for bigger and bigger shocks, I think it will be too late. And I'm going to be talking about some of the reasons why tonight. I don't want to be downbeat, but I think that we do need to be concerned without getting depressed and closing down and feeling hopeless, because you know, I think it is getting worse in the aftermath of the election. Just like with George Bush, we thought we could hope that another 4 years, you know, after he first got elected, we thought in another 4 years we could get rid of him. But no, we had to endure a second 4 years, and now we have 4 more years of this mulatto and his black family and supporters and hanger-ons. And it's going to be bad. I can see it already. The media treats Obama like some kind of a prince who naturally can have things just as he wants them to be. Whites are getting more resigned and unspirited, perhaps, because there's really no direction to go in. So we already see signs of backtracking and lowering expectations. This is not a good idea. We don't have a clear direction, I would say, because no one has the ability to organize anything. Well, when I say we, I don't mean the, you know, all the white people in general, but I mean our whites who are in the know, who are pro-white and racialist. We don't seem to have the ability to organize anything, and it's possible that the white cause has never been so divided as it is now. There's no majority for any idea, and there's very little agreement. John DeNugent and I were Skyping 6 days ago, and he said something I think is very good, which I'm going to repeat. I had used the word movement, but I put it in parentheses, and he came back with, there is no movement, just an infiltrated cause and information on Jews and race. Well, I agree with that. I thought that was pretty darn good. Yeah, we have a cause. We definitely have a cause. We don't have a movement. And we are infiltrated on all sides, and you never know, you don't exactly know just where. It's hard to be, it's hard to trust certain people and things. But we have a lot of information on the internet, on Jews and on race and in books, and we have a lot of information to go by. But we don't have a movement. But, you know, I'm going to ask, you know, just how infiltrated is our cause? Well, I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that. And I, you know, that's a tough one. People, we have to be aware of that, but we don't want to become paranoid. So, you know, I think that right now we should recognize that white people are in crisis. We're in crisis mode. And also in some areas we're in denial. Kevin McDonald is sensing it correctly when he said on this very program 2 weeks ago that he was depressed about what the 2012 election results revealed. A lot of people don't want to admit that, but, you know, I think he's right on. He's right to be depressed about it. What it revealed is still being written about and will continue, no doubt, for quite a while, but it's not looking good, and we are outnumbered, with also the power of the press, the media against us. Hanny Scott said not long ago with me that when I said something like that, he says, well, we have the Internet. Well, yes, but the Internet, for all its good points, doesn't have the authoritative power that the combined media has, although it's a great information source. And that goes back to John DeNugent saying we have information and we have a lot of information. But we're lacking in power, a powerful voice, and in being able to speak from authority, because the mainstream media, in spite of what many of us think, does have that ability to speak from authority. So I believe that what is needed is an across-the-board willingness to point out the Jews as the main problem in white countries. I've been saying that for a long time, but I really believe it. It comes up, you know, and many people say the opposite, that we should not be talking about the Jews all the time, that it upsets people. Well, you know, I think that's just 100% wrong. And I would say that we need to do this in our white countries while they're still considered white countries in most people's minds, because that is fast changing. This is the problem. Very soon we will not be able to claim these countries as ours with any convincingness. While we still can, we should take charge in some way and do something. For that, we have to come to some agreement on what to do. Well, the last people who claimed their country as a white country for themselves, in a sense, or were the National Socialists, Germans, in the 1920s. And they were doing very well until the Jewish Globalist International organized against them. But still, this is our only hope, and it is the truth. That's the thing. It's the truth. Whether people like it or not, it's the truth. We need to become more friendly and less critical of National Socialist Germany and any regime with racialist policies. We have to stop running away from ourselves. And thinking that we'll get to that later. Well, you know, the way I look at it, it's very dangerous for us to think now that we have that much time to do something later on that we're not willing to do now. There are a great many resources to use in convincing and educating people about the history of Jewish intrigue in our nations. One is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which the Jews try so hard to convince everyone is anti-Semitic trash, and that's a sign that they are afraid of what it says. Another, of course, is the Fable of the Holocaust. I will just give a plug for the latest issue, the winter issue of the quarterly online journal Inconvenient History. It just came out, and I read a couple of articles in it already. You can find that at www.inconvenienthistory.com. It always has moderate type revisionist articles that are well researched, that a lot of, you know, average people who are somewhat open-minded can read without getting all upset. And they could be recommended or just sent to those who could use some help along these lines. So don't forget about that resource, Inconvenient History Journal. Let me interject here. that the call-in number, if you want to get on the show and comment on the show subject, is 1-830-433-4911. And you can also send an email to Carolyn at carolynyeager.net. Now, notice I said net, but com will get there too. So either way you do it, I'll get it. But because of things that I've been paying attention to again, like Alexis rankings and so on, which I have gone up in the past year, which is very nice, I have to make a decision I should make a decision between .net or .com and not calling myself one or the other, because actually I've got two rankings, one for .net and one for .com, and it might be causing that same thing for some other things like my downloads and so on. So I'm going to be going with .net, because that's what the vast majority of pages on my website are named, since it was built as CarolynYeager.net, since there was already a CarolynYeager.com in existence, which remained in existence until this was, completed enough. So I own both domains, and either one will get to either my website and also to my email account, but still I'm going to be trying to call my site, CarolynYeager.net. Now, this website, CarolynYeager.net, is finally working as it should. All the troubles I've had all this past year are behind me now. How good that feels, at least I hope they are. They seem to be. And everything is doing well there and functioning just as it should. And that makes me very happy. And it's a big relief, actually. It wasn't cheap, and I would appreciate some contributions toward the upkeep of CarolynYeager.net. Referring to what I said in the beginning about things slowing down, that is one of the things that has really slowed down, even to a standstill, and that is donations. And that goes for the White Network, too. It's just something I have to let you know about in case maybe you just have not thought about it lately. I also manage the EllieWeaselTattoo.com website, and I can tell you honestly that I have never received one thin dime in donations to that site. Nothing. So I'm here complaining about that. I've never really complained about it. I mean, I never really looked for it, but it just is kind of striking now that my expenses have gone up and are going to go up some more. It's more of an issue for me than it used to be. And Bradley Smith of Kodo originally, when the site went up, the donation button went to Kodo, and went to Kodo's PayPal account. But at some point, I don't remember exactly when it was, maybe about a year ago or maybe more than that, he said he wanted that I should switch it over to my PayPal account because I was doing all the work and the money should go to me, and that actually he had never gotten anything that came from EllieWeaselTattoo.com, that said that came via that source anyway, and I have never either. So all the hundreds of hours of work I've put into it since July 2010, and actually started before that, which is 2.5 years now, it's all been for total actual free. Of course, nobody hired me to do it. It's not a job. We have to remember that, and I do remember that. Something I wanted to do, a great labor of, I don't know if it was labor of love, but I was highly motivated to do it and interested in it. But I'll brag a little about it. It contains 75 posts and 40 pages now of carefully researched content, almost all original writing by me. You won't find a more complete resource about Elie Wiesel anywhere, in my opinion. If you think there is, please tell me about it because I want to know. I really do. I think what I've got there, and it will remain, and I may move it to my server to just in the future. I don't know. We'll see. So I'm going to be talking about that. So that's why I brought all this up. I'm going to be talking about the EllieWeaselTattoo.com website tonight to start out. And there's something, uh, there's a what you might say, a project I've got going there that I want you all to know about, and I hope I can get some help with it. I've written the two latest posts that are on there, and I'll go to that now. About Elie Wiesel's, about this AP reporter, Verena Dobnik, who wrote an AP interview article on October 8th. It was published in quite all kinds of newspapers on October 8th. It was released then. And she's with the New York AP New York office. She's written quite a lot of things for AP. Some of the things have to do with Holocaust issues, and some don't, but she says in this, the big thing for me in this interview, because all of it was mostly, you know, the usual stuff about Elie Wiesel had a heart bypass last summer. I didn't know that. I guess nobody knew it. It wasn't advertised or anything, but he did. He had a quadruple heart bypass. Said he was everything was all clogged up. And it's taken him, you know, quite a while to feel better again. And now he hasn't been able to teach, but he hopes to get back to teaching, blah, blah, and a lot of stuff. But in the midst of this, she says that, that he pulls back his jacket sleeve to reveal what she calls a Nazi death camp number tattooed on his forearm. And then he shows it to her and then says to her, usually I don't show it. Well, that's all that was, but it caused, you know, some people wrote to me, and I hadn't done anything on the Elie Wiesel site for quite a while, and my mind was not there, and I couldn't really get into it, you know. I read it, and I thought, well, that's just, you know, something that I should write about, but I don't quite know what to write about it, so I thought maybe there would be some follow-up, you know, to it. I thought maybe there would be some talk about it. Maybe there'd be other articles in the news. Maybe people would be saying something. But no, nothing. Nothing. It was just ignored. Even though, and for most people, well, they wouldn't think much about it. But for me, and for people who follow Elie Wiesel Cons the World website, it's a big deal, because our whole thing there is, where's the tattoo? Where's Ellie's tattoo? And while there's a whole lot else there about Elie Wiesel, this is kind of the mainstay, or the, well, I can't think of the hook that it's all hooked onto. The fact that Elie Wiesel has always said he's got this tattoo, but he won't ever show it. So, but after a while, I finally got around to writing about it. And so I wrote one post on, let's see. When did I write that? I wrote the first one on November 7th. And then on November 8th, I wrote to the AP, because as I was writing that, I got all that information about the AP. I looked it up, you know, if they would, and how I could get hold of this author, Verena Dobnik, and so on. And I thought, well, I'll try to do that and try to get the readers to do that. I don't know if anybody's done it except this one fellow who wrote in and said he did, and that is Roger. Roger did, and other people wrote. I got comments about the posts, but I didn't. Nobody said, "Hey, I sent in an email to him," or "I called him." Anyway, I gave the number and all that, and I called myself the next day, and I wrote an email, and I. Got, of course, when I called, I was put on a voicemail, and I left my messages, but nobody got back to me. So later I called again, I got voicemail again, left the message. Then on November 14th, I decided to send another email and make it a little stronger, and I still didn't get anything. And I called on Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And talked, the fellow that answered finally, he connected me with a communications person, And they didn't. I had to leave a message there. No, that was, I guess, the time before. So on the day before, on Wednesday before Thanksgiving, he connected me with media relations. Because I think he knew, they already had it down who that I was, this person that was calling and writing. And, but because it was the day before Thanksgiving, the man had a pretty good excuse for saying that he, again, it was voicemail. He would try to call me back, but maybe he wouldn't be able to. He's in and out. Anyway, I didn't, I sent that other email, and then I waited until today. And I called and I talked to a woman in communications department again. And she was trying to just take my message and then say, all right, thank you, you know, and I didn't let her get away with that because I insisted that I wanted to hear from somebody. I insisted, I told her everything about it, you know, what I was concerned about, and that it was false, fraudulent journalism, and that I didn't believe Irina Dobnik actually, you know, saw a tattoo on Elie Wiesel's arm and why I didn't believe it. And I went through the whole thing with her, and, you know, of course, they have to be polite, and she says, you know, so I said, I want to hear from Irina Dobnik. You don't have an email address for her, or I want to hear from AP. I want an explanation. I want an answer to my concern that considering the history of Elie Wiesel's tattoo, that it's not believable. And the way she writes it, she doesn't describe it. She doesn't, you know, make it convincing. I think it's a big lie. And so she promised me that if I would resend my latest email, which they don't read them, that she would look for it and she would address it. And I said she would send it on to the right person. I said, well, I want not only that, I want to be sure that they reply to me. I don't just want it to be sent on and then nothing. She said she would be sure to follow through on that. So I did that today, and I'm waiting for the answer, and I will write more about it. And so therefore, I want to encourage those of you, if you think that this is a waste of time, I think you're wrong. Because we don't get very many opportunities to have a really good issue. And I do believe that this is a really good issue. Because the AP and or this reporter, but you know, they have to stand behind her, or she's with them, and they have to answer for her. They are liable to answer this, to answer to this, and to say something about it, to do something about it. Of course, it may be that they won't. It all depends on how much problem they have with it. And if they get a lot of emails and phone calls, then they will have to take it seriously. If they don't, they won't. Because if it's just me, they can ignore me, no matter how much noise I make. So they shouldn't, but that they know that most people aren't going to care. So there has to be enough response from our community. And this is where we fall down, where we follow all the, going back to what John Mnuchin said, information on race and what was the other thing? Information on Jews and race. Yeah, we follow all the information, but when it comes to actually taking part in something, it doesn't happen. You know, when this website, Elie Wiesel tattoo.com, was just getting underway in the second month, we started, and I had the help of one person who joined in, Steve Bach, who did a lot of work. He helped a lot. And we had this project to send, to write to the professors and so on at Boston University, where Elie Wiesel works, and talk about this tattoo issue. And I sent a very good letter, and we sent a whole bunch of them to all these other department heads and so on. We had a whole list of everything, and we asked people to do this, And I don't think that much was ever done because, see, they think that somebody else should do it, but not them. So if they, if Boston University had gotten a lot of noise from this, they would have had to respond better than they did. Although I did get a response from the president. So he did take it that seriously. So what I'm asking people to do here is not hard. It's just, I've got the phone number and the, well, I'll just give you the phone number right now to the, AP, New York office, 212-621-1500, 212-621-1500, or you can send an email or both to info@ap.org, info@ap.org. Very simple. And, let's see here. I have some advice for you. Be sure that you make clear that you want to hear from someone. When you get the first person that answers, if you call, that answers at AP, tell them what you're calling about, give them your name, and tell them you want to talk to someone who, you know, in authority about this. And if they connect you with this communications department or with media relations, which I think is higher up, then you can tell them and just, be polite but forceful enough that you are serious about this. Make clear that it's not a small or insignificant matter, but it's a huge matter of potential lying, meaning journalistic fraud. You know how many scandals there have been about journalistic fraud. Of course, a lot of them are about plagiarism. But still, as soon as I mentioned journalistic fraud to this woman, she acted differently. She paid more attention. See, this is something they have to pay attention to. So use these words. And if reporters are, well, it's like this. If reporters are going to say that they saw Weasel's tattoo, say, well, we want to see it too, or why should we believe them that they saw it? This is not the way things work. You know, they shouldn't be saying things like this because it's not like, anybody has ever seen it. I mean, it's not like he's ever shown it to anybody ever. So that's what makes it a special deal. So, you know, when we have an opening like this, we have to push. When I talked earlier, I opened up the program with discussion about how, what condition we're in and why we're in this condition. Well, I didn't say too much about why we're in this condition, but, you know, we're in a losing position. We're in a losing, battle here, and we have to start taking action, and we have to take advantage of every opening. Now, to a lot of people who aren't paying attention, who only think of Elie Wiesel as, oh, that guy who was in Auschwitz and told all those lies, and they don't want to think past that. They don't want to think past the fact that that as long as he's still alive, we can keep, you know, we can keep pressing some of these issues that he is very, very vulnerable about. And it's not a minor matter. Elie Wiesel is a very, very important person. Elie Wiesel, hangs out with presidents. Let's see, what is this? I've got something posted here I'm going to get rid of. Okay. I could read you my email, the email that I sent. Well, I resent the first one this morning instead of the second one. But, you can also read it on the website, so I'm not going to do that, so I can get in all the rest of this. So let me see here. Let's think about talking about Elie Wiesel. You know, what's going to happen when this guy dies? Yeah, I've mentioned this before because I know what's going to happen. Streets all over America and the world will be named after him. Schools, too. Watch the elementary schools, particularly. becoming Elie Wiesel, you know, elementary school, here, there, everywhere. Government buildings, libraries, memorials will be erected. The Jews will make sure that that happens because, you know, they will turn him into Saint Elie the Wiesel, as I've mentioned before. Once they do that, then the person, you know, like Abraham Lincoln or something, becomes permanently enshrined in our history and in our children's thinking, teaching, and so on, as one of the great beings that we honor and look to. Whereas we still have the opportunity to take away from that. If you think it's easier after he dies, I don't know where people get this idea. They think that if we wait longer, things are going to be easier. No, if we wait longer, things are only going to be more difficult. That's the way I see it. This will happen with Elie Wiesel because we wouldn't do anything to stop it. Sienna. And your children, I'm going to really go at it now, your children and your grandchildren will blame you, just as you blame your parents and grandparents for not stopping the Jews earlier when they still could have. There's a lot that could have been done back when, and it wasn't done. We say, gee, why didn't they do that then when before it got so far, before everything came so far? Well, it's the same thing going to be for the children, saying, why didn't they stop this? Well, every time we have an opportunity to do something, we don't have the participation that we should have, and it's not like it's hard to do. So I'm hoping, because I'm going to follow up on this, and so I'm really hoping those of you who listen to this program will pass the word around to as many others as possible, and we'll take these simple steps tomorrow. You know, do it tomorrow. I've said, and I do believe that if those people at the AP got even 10 emails, and now that she's looking out for mine, she told me to put the information in the subject so she wouldn't miss it. Oh yeah, I think I forgot to mention that. I wonder why. Where does it say that? Put in the subject line, make sure you put in the subject line of your email something like Verena Dobnik. I had that all written out. I wonder what happened to it. Verena Dobnik, AP reporter, October 8th interview. You know, at least something like that so they know, so that they're alerted to what it's about. Don't put in the subject line of your email Elie Wiesel or Elie Wiesel tattoo or that. No, be clear that you're talking about a story of theirs. AP story, October 8th, Verena Dobnik, by Verena Dobnik, so that they know you're dealing with a particular story that belongs to them. They don't care about Elie Wiesel and his tattoo. They care about, you know, their news stories and what people are saying about them, writing to them about them. So, all right. I'll repeat that I do ask you, I really ask you to do that. A special request for me, for those of you who are listening, and use your real name if you can. If you can't, just, you know, come up with something else, a concerned reader or something like that. But at least you'll have an email. They'll know it's somebody. And another thing that we can say and talk to about people. And I don't know if you'd want to bother with it in this email because it should be fairly short and to the point, or they don't want to read something long. So remember that it can be fairly long if you really have something important to put in it. But, you know, otherwise, don't be too brief, but be somewhat brief. It's just uncanny that the mass media all over the world, particularly our world, the U.S. and Canada, Britain, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, the Western world, says nothing about Weasel's tattoo or any other aspect of his unverified story. I mean, because of that, well, what they do say are just, they promote the same old official story. But they don't ever want to tell you about anything that anyone brings up. And that shows that it's all a big cover-up. I mean, it's clear that they're covering up things. They're going along with things. They're not doing their job. And that should be addressed when there's an opportunity to do so with these newspapers people. And it's in the same category with Barack Obama's birth certificate. They refused to pick up on that story. That was a valid story, very valid. They refused to deal with it. So, going on with more, around the same time, Elie Wiesel, it came out in a story about Elie Wiesel that he was writing a book with Barack Obama. You know, I say he was caught imagining. You know, he's so great at imagining. Elie Wiesel has imagined all kinds of things. Now he's imagining that he's writing a book with Barack Obama. I don't know where he got that idea, but Obama certainly disabused him of that idea, and his spokespeople came out shortly afterwards and said, no, Barack Obama was not writing a book with Elie Wiesel, and he was writing a book on his own about something, you know, his first 4 years or whatever. And they didn't word it in any way like, well, you know, to soften it about Elie Wiesel or say, you know, explain how he might have gotten that idea, whatever. They just came out flat out and said no. So, but this showed up in The Guardian in Britain, this story, and several U.S. newspapers carried it, but it originated in Haaretz, that Israeli newspaper, and let's see. It says that Holocaust survivor and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel has said he is writing a book with President Obama fresh from election victory. Speaking to Israeli news site Haaretz, the author, 84, said he was working on a project which would pick up again after Tuesday's presidential elections were over. Quote from Wiesel. Obama and I decided to write a book together, a book of two friends. And then they talk about, you know, how he wrote Night and so on. However, okay. Now, that's all, basically all that I saw. But actually, the original article in Haaretz had a whole lot of stuff in it. And it was a long interview with him while he was in Israel, and which took place in November. It's dated November 2nd, written by Ofer Adaret. So, you know, he's an Israeli Jew. Wiesel's a Jew. So these two Jews are coming up with whatever they said here. Wiesel talks about his open heart surgery, which I already told you about. And then he says how he became friends with Obama in 2009, a few months after the Democratic candidate was elected. Obama's staff invited Wiesel to join the president on a visit to the site of Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany. So according to him, and it's probably true, that Obama invited him to be present while he went to Buchenwald. And, you know, I was in Germany at that time. Just so happened that coincided with when I was there. And I was even in Dresden when Obama came to Dresden and caused that whole inner city, where all the tourists want to go, where I wanted to go, to be closed down for 2 days, shut down while they were blocking everything and doing all this security work. You should have seen what was going on there. You should have seen it. I mean, police vehicles and all kinds of city vehicles and security vehicles all over. They had it all roped off, you know, with tape and everything. This huge area that everybody at that time wanted to go into, but you couldn't go into because Obama was coming. And he came to Dresden after being in Buchenwald. I watched on the German TV showing him at Buchenwald and with Wiesel and Chancellor Merkel and all of that. And then I think I was in Berlin then, and I wasn't paying enough attention to the news because I was all caught up in, you know, going to the places I wanted to go to. And when I got, the day I got to Dresden from Berlin, I finally got to my lodgings. And after I got everything put away and came down to leave and go into the city, into the city center, the lady that ran the place told me that it was going to be all closed down that night. I better hurry because it was going to be all shut down for 2 days because Obama was coming. And I just about had a fit. I thought, oh no, what a bad luck for me, you know. I went rushing down there and I was, going as, to see as many things as I could. It wasn't a very nice day. It was kind of cold and cloudy. And they were setting up, they had all their junk all around there. They were setting up all this, how they were going to shut it down. The next day, it was all roped off, taped off. And they actually was only a day and a half. So the day following that, they opened it up again. And you should see what they had, all they had to do. They had every manhole taped down with this yellow, I don't mean just tape. I mean this big yellow stuff, plastic stuff, like thick, big, huge pieces of sticky stuff that you couldn't. I was trying to pick away at the corner of one, you know. I mean, it is such tough stuff. You could not pick away at it at all. I guess they used something to get it up again. But I was told they spent, I don't know how many millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, it cost Germany to securitize that part of Dresden so that Obama could come and spend an hour in the castle with having a talk with Merkel and then go and tour the Frauenkirche, which is the Church of Our Lady, you know, the Church of the Virgin, which is the one that was such a favorite in Dresden and was bombed, totally destroyed, and was rebuilt and so on. It was only rebuilt a few years back, but not that long ago. They finally were able to rebuild it. And here's something that always, I heard about it at the time and I didn't like it. I just don't have this forgiving spirit, that they think you're supposed to have, that they make a big deal out of the fact that the new cross, tower cross, just this cross that goes at the top, the very top of the church tower, was paid for by the people of Great Britain, you know, after this church was rebuilt. And it was crafted by the son of one of the British pilots who bombarded the city. You know, it was supposed to be so heartwarming, so wonderful. So I thought, God, the people of Great Britain and the people of the United States should have paid for the whole rebuilding of the church in the whole darn country. But no, they paid for this cross to go on the top of one church in Dresden. Okay, I had to say that because, you know, I just vent a little bit. So so how did I get onto this? I was talking about this in the article. Now, and you know, here we're getting, I don't know if I made this point clear enough. You know, the United States said Obama would come and visit Germany, and he went to Dresden because here it is. It has more to, this is what I found out in Time magazine. It had more to do with his tight schedule. He went to Dresden rather than Berlin And so then Merkel had to go to Dresden to meet him because of his tight schedule, which left scant time between his Egypt visit. Remember, he went to Egypt first, Obama. And he was newly elected then. So this was kind of a, you know, he was getting the benefit of this. Germany didn't get any benefit out of it. He went to Egypt first. And then Friday afternoon, he went to Buchenwald concentration camp. And he was going to the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center to meet with wounded U.S. soldiers. And, of course, we still had the war in Iraq going on then, I believe so, and plus Afghanistan. And he wanted to make a big show going to see U.S. soldiers who were in a medical center in Germany. And he wanted to make a big show at Buchenwald with Elie Wiesel. And then he had time to squeeze in this visit with Merkel, but he didn't have time to go to Berlin. He had to just go to Dresden. So Dresden had to tear up and securitize their whole area there at the cost of millions to themselves. But they did it. They thought they were so honored to have this Barack Obama come and visit their city. Okay, that's the background of all that. So I'm going to skip some of what they talked about. But Wiesel says that he and Barack Obama have become good friends, and they occasionally have dinner together and talk about philosophy, contemplation, thought, but never about politics, Wiesel says. Wiesel says he is a thinking person, a person with depth and intellectual curiosity. Well, you know, to Wiesel, his freshman students have depth and intellectual curiosity. Anybody that is interested in what he has to say has depth. So I don't think Obama has to have all that much depth. They asked him, do you never talk about Israel? Wiesel answers, from time to time, we also mention Israel. He is critical about some things, but show me any president who has not been. I try to explain to him the meta-historical aspect of what is happening in Israel and of the Jewish destiny. I have faith in him. You can talk to him. He is a good listener. So, you know, Wiesel believes in the Jewish destiny. The Jewish destiny in Israel. If Obama is critical about some things about Israel, it is no doubt their expansionist policies, right? But Elie Wiesel tries to explain to him the meta-historical background and what is really happening in Israel and the Jewish destiny there and so on. So you can imagine what he's saying, and you know he's a great lover of the Talmud, so that you know what his beliefs are, and you would wish that Obama would not consider him such a good friend. But anyway, now, Wiesel also knows Benjamin Netanyahu very well, and he says he met him in this interview. He says he met him when Netanyahu was still a young man after the Entebbe operation in 1976, in which Netanyahu's brother Yoni was killed. Wiesel received a letter from their father, Benzion Netanyahu, and Wiesel says, he wrote me that my books had influenced Yoni and that my books were mentioned in his letters and diaries. So a few weeks later, Wiesel said Netanyahu Sr. showed up at his office, accompanied by a young man who sat in the corner and listened to their conversation. The youngster was Bibi. He was a student in the United States at the time. And after that, Bibi came frequently to Wiesel's office because he was in the United States. Wiesel says he never told me what he wanted. I suppose he wanted to meet the person who had an influence on his brother. He's asked what his opinion of Netanyahu's performance as prime minister is. And here's the typical Wiesel stuff. I know that politics in Israel is existential, not like in America, where I live and work. So I am very careful about giving advice. After all, who am I? I know that there is sensitivity here to the historical nexus, without which one cannot understand what is going on in this place. A tiny country surrounded by enemies, which always has to contemplate its survival. Yep, here we go. Politics in Israel is existential. That means it's all about whether it exists or not. It's, you know, it's dealing with its very existence all the time. And it's contemplated, it's dealing with its survival. It's a matter of survival in Israel. Uh-huh. They've got all those nuclear bombs, but they're just worried about their survival. He's asked, since some of this is interesting, he's asked if he accepts the analogy Netanyahu draws between the Iranian nuclear project and the Holocaust. You know how Netanyahu is always talking about that there's going to be another Holocaust and the Iranians are going to be responsible for it. Weasel says, I understand why he is making the analogy, but I would not make it. I never draw comparisons. After all, words fail when it comes to the Holocaust. I never compare the Holocaust to any other tragedy, but I am not prime minister. For the past 3 years, I have been waging a struggle against Ahmadinejad around the world, demanding that he be arrested and placed on trial, as was done to Eichmann. He should be charged with a desire to commit genocide. I hope the Mossad, which caught a man like Eichmann, will be able to catch him and get him tried in an international court. Someone like him must not be allowed to sleep quietly. Amazing, you know, that the way he thinks is the Talmudic way and is definitely the Jewish way. He doesn't understand the way we think. Why would a man be arrested and put on trial for what he says, having a desire to commit genocide? You know, he is not committing any genocide, Ahmadinejad. Iran has never done anything like that. Iran is not saying they want to commit genocide. They're not preparing to commit genocide. But Weasel says that he knows that Ahmadinejad has a desire to do that, and so does Netanyahu think that. So he wants him to be tried in an international court. Based on that. You know, if these Jews, the way they want things to be would be just totally intolerable. We would all, if they got total control, we would all be wanting to take a cyanide capsule, believe me. So then the questioner asks, is liquidation also an option? Weasel says, I would not say to liquidate. I can't hear myself saying that to someone, saying that someone should be killed. I am not capable of that. Ha! I don't believe that. Then he goes on to talk about he's asked about the monument to in Berlin to the gypsies, the Holocaust of the gypsies. And he says, I remember the night on which all the gypsies in Birkenau were counted. It happened close to where I was. It was impossible not to hear. But I am against comparisons. It is wrong to compare one person's death to that of another. If in present-day culture a monument is what is crucial, then fine. Who am I to tell them how to remember? I respect their right. And the refugee problem in Israel was brought up to him. And again, you know, he avoids it by saying, I came to Paris after the war as a refugee. We had nowhere to go. I also came to the United States as a refugee. When I hear the word refugees, I automatically and emotionally identify with their rights. And then he says that he applauds Prime Minister Menachem Begin for bringing refugees from Vietnam to Israel. I see that as a great compliment to Israel, he says, which constitutes a hope for refugees. If I were in the government, I would persuade the prime minister to see the beauty in the fact that people see Israel as a haven from their sadness to their hope. Israel as a haven for foreigners. Oh, boy. You know, and I wonder how many Vietnamese were brought by Begin to Israel. Are they still there? I mean, what happened to them? I've never heard of Vietnamese in Israel. But he answers a man who says, a professor, a Jewish professor, an educator who recently died, said the Holocaust should be forgotten. And he was critical of the intensity with which it was implanted in the consciousness of the Israeli public. And they wanted to know what Wiesel thought about that. He said, I will not argue with the deceased, but I think the exact opposite. The Holocaust must be remembered with the pain. A Jewish people without a memory has nothing to do here. The Bible, Abraham, Moses, the problem is different. The human brain is not capable of absorbing all these memories because there are too many of them. Whom shall we remember? Only the relatives? Only those who were put to death as soon as they arrived at the train? Only the children? Is it good for us to learn and know the limits of humanity? And then he says, we must not forget what civilized people once did. People raised on Kant, Fichte, and Hegel. People who listened to Beethoven and read Schiller in the morning. And in the afternoon, kill children and parents. You know, how many times he has talked like this? And yet to say that these German people were listening to Beethoven and reading Schiller in the morning and then going out and killing children and parents in the afternoon is just so far-fetched, so far away from what actually was. Well, I'm at the break time. I'm going to start here, and we'll go on to a lot of other type of stories away from Elie Wiesel when I get back, ladies and gentlemen, so stay with me.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang. Und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht, und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Sie erzählt von einer Zeit, für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang. Und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager, and I was just checking my email to see if anybody had answered me about if they heard any hissing, but you don't. I'm sure it's just something that's happened to these earphones of mine. But you know what I found there was an email from Paul Blake, who I've heard from him before, and I'm just flabbergasted. He writes and tells me, and there is a donation notification also, email, that I didn't open, but he said, I just donated $300 to the Elie Wiesel, website as soon as I heard you had never received any donation for your Elie Wiesel work, to show that I greatly appreciate what you've done on this subject and am as interested as you in this cause. I really want to thank Paul. That is fantastic. I've never received a donation of that much money. The most I've received other than this was $150, which also flabbergasted me once by a very nice person. But this is really nice, and thanks to Paul. But Paul also said that he hadn't followed up on what I had asked for writing into AP on this subject, because he thinks all newspaper articles are as faulty as that one. They're all bad. Well, they are all bad, but I think that he's going to think about it some more. But I think that there's a difference. I don't think this is just like anything that they say about the Holocaust or about Elie Wiesel, but this is something. This tattoo issue is very different. And has something going for it that other things don't, and I've always thought so. And that's why the Elie Wiesel website is, as I say, kind of hooked onto that, because he has claimed so many times that he has it, and whether he was really at Auschwitz or not also is questionable, and that's that is linked in with having a tattoo too. At least you don't have to have a tattoo to have been in Auschwitz, but he says he has one. And so any opportunity to point out that he says that and he won't show it, and I believe he won't show it because absolutely he does not have one. I'm quite positive he does not have one, and I don't care if somehow it turns out that he will all of a sudden show his arm and he's got a tattoo. I'll be happy. If he does that, then we can go from there and say, well, where did this tattoo come from and what does it look like and so on? Or at least we're forcing him to do something. But I think the reason that he never has is not because of modesty or because he doesn't want to show his arm, his body, because he's shown it plenty of times before, and there was nothing there. But it's because he doesn't have it. And here's the thing where the news media goes right along with it and will not, does not care about the truth. Now, I want to go back. I've got a lot of stuff I want to say yet, but I want to go back to, I want to give out the phone number again. 1-830-443-4911. 1-830-443-4911 or carolyn@carolynyager.net. I didn't have any questions in my email. But when they talk about how the German people, the people of Beethoven and Schiller, the people of Kant, Fichte, and Hegel could go out and do what they did, you know, to the Jews, just unbelievable. That means anybody can. That means civilization doesn't exist. That means, you know, people are not really, have not really advanced at all. Not these, white people, especially not Germans. Well, you know, would you say that American soldiers who are in, right now, let's say Afghanistan, are familiar with Walt Whitman, Ralph Waldo Emerson, or William James, who are American philosophers? Do they read them, these philosophers in the morning and then go out and kill, innocent Afghans in the afternoon? Is that the way it works? It's just so stupid to say that. And the purpose of not only Elie Wiesel, but others in saying this about the, particularly about the National Socialist Germans is to undermine German culture. To say, oh, the Germans had all this great culture, but it didn't get through to them. You know, they didn't, they're impossible. If with all those great men, they couldn't, they still did what they did, that they aren't better, then nothing will help them. They're just savages. And it also, disrespects, the culture of Germany, you know, the names that are mentioned here. By connecting them with people who kill and maim for no good reason, just out of hate and so on. So it's all a part of the demoralization of Germans and the destruction, what's the right word to use? Not the, just, I don't want to say the destruction, but the bringing down, you know, of the German, people of the German nation. Which is what they really want to do. So going on with this real quickly, a few things that they asked Elie Wiesel that are important were that, as they think about death and so on, he says, well, you know, yes, he does. He says, I lived with the dead and amid death, I knew that every hour could be the last and every day the final one. But that's not true. He wasn't ever in any danger of being put to death. But he says, it is part of my character and nature. He says, I am not now preparing anything, but one of my students is now organizing my archive. He found thousands of things which I myself no longer knew existed. It takes a great deal of time. My archives will be stored at Boston University, where I have worked for 40 years. So there it is, you know, he could have predicted that, but there, Boston University is going to house a big Elie Wiesel library, be like a presidential library, be erected there to hold his archives. Then it comes up that he's, you know, talked about how his son and two grandchildren also live in the United States, and he, says that, well, they're talking about his father's name. His father's name was Shlomo, but his middle name was Elisha. Shlomo Elisha. Now, Wiesel has named his son Elisha Shlomo. And of course, his name is, Eleazar, and he was named after his grandfather, Eleazar. So that's how they do it in these families. And he says, you know, he loved the Talmud. Weasel. But he also wanted to study the Kabbalah and so on, in Kabbalah. And he says, when I was 13, my father told me, it is fine that you study Talmud every day, but I want you to learn modern Hebrew as well. So he found a tutor for him in Hebrew. Well, they say that because this interviewer and him were conversing in Hebrew. They were doing this interview in Hebrew. Then he talks about, here's the part. Now, he says in here that he has never used a computer. He's talking about radio and television have taken the place of newspapers, which is what he likes best. And then the interviewer said, we're in the age of the internet, and you're talking about radio and television. And Weasel says, to this day, I don't know how to use it. I do not belong to this world. I continue to write everything in longhand. If I have to see something on the internet, I ask my secretary or students. I am lucky because I have people who do it for me. I can allow myself not to learn the things I do not know. I was going to say, you know, he's never seen Elie Wiesel Kahn's world. He probably hasn't. He probably never looks at anything that is critical of himself. He only looks at newspapers and books and so on, and talks to people who are, you know, fond of him and say good things about him, and that's all he ever sees. Now, he knows that he has detractors, because he knows that there are all these Holocaust deniers. But and if somebody tells him to look at something on the internet, I guess one of his students or a secretary will pull it up for him and he can look at it. But he doesn't really look at this stuff. So he's not paying any attention to what we're trying to do, which I'm not surprised at all. I sort of never thought he looked at, you know, Elie Wiesel Kahn's The World. But he says, my son was studying computer sciences at Yale. He told me he was ashamed to say that his father didn't use a computer. So he brought me a computer and said, at least see what it is. That day I wrote 12 pages on the computer with two fingers. The spirit descended upon me and I knew it was good. But suddenly the screen went black. I sat there literally gaping. I switched colors. The machine got Alzheimer's. Well, that's the end of this interview, but I think he lost his 12 pages, and that's why he says the machine got Alzheimer's. Kind of funny, you know. I don't know about the switching colors. I don't know what he means by that. But anyway, he doesn't use a computer. He's not looking at the computer. And at the end of this, there's something else I want to say before I talk about Weasel's son, Elisha, who did get a degree in computer sciences at Yale. At the end of the Dobnik interview, he mentions that his goal for the last 20 years of his life has been to fight racism and hatred by organizing global gatherings with high power participants. So he believes in globalism, except for Israel. Since Israel will be the ruler of the globe, you know, Israel will be the ruler of all that is pulled together under globalism, not a part of it. And he knows that. He knows that's the plan. Obama's inauguration, he says, was one of the most joyous days of my life because my people, the American people, showed they could overcome a disease, hatred because of color. My people, the American people. First, his people are not the American people, and we all know it. His people are just the Jews. And he never gets out of New York and goes and sees the people of America. He's always in New York unless he goes out to make a speech somewhere, or he goes to another, you know, travels around the world to do his thing like that. So he doesn't know anything, you know, but he wants to be a hero of the American people. And as I said already, when he dies, all this stuff is going to be erected for him in America. And second, he says that racism is a disease if you hate people because of color. Again, bringing up that color is race, you know, but color is not race. It's not even the most important part of race. Liberals always do this. They try to say that we hate people because of their color, the color of their skin. Now, you all know that if a person that was white in every way, including features, everything, but they happen to have dark color, dark or even black skin, but everything else about them was white, their hair, their features, their personality, so on, would anybody care about their color? No. No. I mean, I've known that all along. It's not the color. But they always want to say that, so that they can make it into some kind of an unreasonable disease. So in this, following this, which I didn't bring up in my blogs because it seemed like a totally different subject, Weasel said at the end of this interview with Verena Dobnik, someday he believes his grandchildren will applaud the first Jewish president in America. So, boy, I picked up on that, the first Jewish president in America. Well, we find out, I was never paying much attention to his son. I always imagined him still as a young kid, I guess. But he was born in 1972. He's now 40, actually 41 years old. And he has two children, a son and a daughter. And they are named Syria or something and Elijah. His son is named Elijah. And the daughter is something like Saria or something. And I don't know their ages, but they would, you know, be kids. And so it won't be long before they could be, they'll be grown up or certainly aware enough to applaud the first Jewish president in America. So that is on its way if these people have their way. Now, I got some strange long thing here. So now I want to talk about Elisha Weasel. I looked him up and found, to my amazement, but I was pleased, but when I say pleased, well, it was like, wow. He is employed by, guess what? Goldman Sachs. He's a partner at Goldman Sachs and Company. Elie Weasel's son. He's called a financial professional. He's had an industry securities registration for 6 years. And he, therefore, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. His education is, he has only a bachelor's degree, Bachelor of Science in Computer Sciences. And so maybe that's good enough for him to be working at Goldman Sachs, because I don't think Goldman Sachs partners have to have you know, PhDs in philosophy or economics or anything like that. I think they're just, if they're good financial brokers or financial advisors, if they're good, you know, selling stuff, that's all that's important. I don't know how good Elisha Weasel is, but I'm sure he got that because he's Elie Weasel's son, and he may not be too good at anything, but they gave him this so that, you know, he could be taken care of. In any case, he's also on the board of directors for this, charity type thing called Groundwork Incorporated, which is an outreach effort for New York City's predominantly black children. They say it's 51% black and 39% Latino children they serve, but on their website, they have, which is at groundwork.org maybe. They have a whole lot of pictures and they're all of black kids. That's all I see is black kids. And they, you know, it's kind of like a Head Start type thing or No Child Left Behind. They're supposedly this organization, helps these kids, this Elisha Weasel is responsible, given credit for getting Goldman Sachs to donate $1 million to this, to Groundwork's efforts to improve the program quality, the organizational capacity, and student performance. So, it was organized by him, and this program seeks to strengthen the lives that help these kids in four key intervention points in their life: early childhood, fourth grade, middle school, and ninth grade. Mr. Elisha Weasel says, I am continually inspired by the work being done by the staff and youth of Groundwork as they positively transform the East New York community. It's hard to imagine a more compelling return on capital than what Groundwork achieves every day. Now, Elisha Weasel is also a board member of Shepherd Services, which is committed to helping councils and other organizations operate efficiently by providing proven and practical systems. I think that's just one of those positions where he was asked to be a member of their board. It's nothing to do with particularly with any of these topics I'm talking about. It's just a business. And so, you know, you make money when you're a board member, and people who, there's these people who get invited on these boards. Now, he's only 40. He'll probably get on to quite a few other boards eventually, and to, you know, give him a higher income. Okay, here's, so in another place, it says that he's a chief risk officer of the securities division at Goldman Sachs and Company. Let's just remember that it was Goldman Sachs that went to Greece and helped the Greeks get themselves into so much trouble by pulling scams on the European Union, really, and taking advantage of how they could get all this low-income loans. And they got them into huge amounts of debt, telling them they could always pay it back, I guess. And now Greece is in the terrible situation it's in. All of Europe is, and Goldman Sachs played a big role in that. And this is where this damn son of Elie Wiesel is employed. And he may just need his computer skills to be a chief risk officer of the securities division. Maybe he just checks all this stuff out in that way, you know. Not necessarily internet, you know, other types of computer work. So, now, you know, a picture that I'm going to be using shows Elisha standing next to his father as he got the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. And he has this, you know, I hate to say that he's a smirk, got a smirk on his face. Because you never know when somebody's got their picture taken, you know, what kind of what way they might be moving their face to look terrible, you know, to not look very good in the picture or to look a certain way. He might not be a smirky guy, but he's 14 years old in this picture, and he definitely has a look of a smirky, superior acting kind of guy. But, you know, like I say, it's not fair to judge that from one photograph. Anyway, his children are named Elijah and Shira, and they're waiting for their first Jewish president of the United States to arrive so they can applaud him. Now, this business about, I don't think I'm going to read this because it's been talked about a lot, Weasel and his relationship with Madoff and the things that he said. You know, of course, he blamed all... here's some of the things he said. Psychopath is too nice a word for a Madoff. He was at a panel discussion, and he got very emotional. They said this was in 2009, shortly after it all took place. And then he says about Madoff, Weasel did. He says he presented himself as a philanthropist. He gave so much money to institutions. So this was supposed to explain partly why Weasel went along with him, you know, and gave him his money. He says that given Madoff's reputation, particularly among Jews, trust was not an issue. He said there was a myth he created around him. His expertise was so special, it had to be a secret. He gave the impression maybe 100 people were part of his club. Now we know there are thousands. Well, obviously, Weasel met Madoff personally, talked to him and all that, and he was impressed. And he said that when Madoff's statements arrived, which are now known to be false, and they showed his investments skyrocketing, Weasel decided to hand over the assets of his charity to Madoff. So you see, you know, and then he talks like he's such a modest man. He's not greedy or anything. He doesn't care about money. Yeah, but he tries to say that it was all just for his foundation. And he said, "We thought we did so well. Everyone told us you can make so much more profit because of Mr. Madoff, the savior." Those are Weasel's words. Now, I'm saying this because I got three stories about Jews cheating people to make money that I want to bring up because as I started out the program, we're talking about how we need to inform our people and all the people that we can, but particularly white people, about the truth about the Jews. We can't keep quiet about the Jews and keep them, and they'll just remain, not ever wanting to think about them, talk about them, say anything about them, believe anything bad about them. You know, we have to start breaking into this, and I wanted to go into more about some of the white leaders, but I don't really have time to do that right now. I might at the very end, but, you know, I'll just say right now that Kevin McDonald mentioned on my show, on this show, 2 weeks ago, that he speaks about the Jews, and of course he does. Great. He's one of the main ones who's brought us so much knowledge about the Jewish, not just Jewish power, but Jewish intentions and the Jewish methods, the way they work. And so, but so many others don't want to do that. Of course, David Duke wrote his books, his two books, exposing the Jews. But he doesn't talk about them too much now. But there are others who don't want to talk about them. And I think that's just a big mistake. I think that we need to talk about Jews in a united front, you know, to convince people that this is where the problem is. And there are those who want to say this is not where the problem is. Oh, the problem is with us. Well, we have problems with us, but mostly because the Jews have hemmed us in so badly that people don't know where to go. And then there are all those who are not part of our persuasions who think that it's anti-Semitism and it's wrong. So in order to break, this is what needs to be broken through. And people need to be educated about the Jews in an intelligent and reasonable fashion, not by, you know, shouting out insults and crazy things and so on, even though they might be true. So this week, a stockbroker, just this week, named Nicholas Levin in Great Britain was jailed for 13 years for cheating investors out of £32 million, what ended up as a classic Ponzi scheme. So it says in the story about him that he joins a recent roll call of charlatans headed by Bernard Madoff, who's now serving 150 years for his £40 billion scam. Now, this guy is only £32 million. It's very small compared to Madoff, but it's a lot of money. And they said we can also recall in Great Britain Roger Levitt, the disgraced financial advisor, who got away with, who cheated investors out of £34 million in 1990. He went bankrupt in 1990. So Levitt is Jewish, is a Jewish name. I found out that this Levin, spelled L-E-V-E-N-E, is also Jewish. I wasn't sure at first, but I thought he must be. You know, you can, but I did find out for sure because it says that his lifestyle grew to include a chauffeur-driven Bentley, a 10,000-pound-a-day pheasant shoots, villas in Israel, and a 588,000-pound bar mitzvah party for his son, held in Battersea Park in 2009 and organized by Banana Split, the creatives behind Simon Cowell's 50th birthday bash. Well, Simon Cowell is a Jew, you know, from the, Stars, where people go and I can't think of the name of that program, but y'all know Simon Cowell. He's British too. And how did he get to be such a big shot, so popular and all? Cause they just played him up and they gave him that position, that job, cause he's a Jew. And, so we have, this Levin, whose son had a bar mitzvah. Yeah, he's Jewish. So it says, if you look at the personality profile of these people, they're all very much the same. This is this writer who studied them writes this. Says they have very strong personalities. They're charismatic and able to emotionally manipulate people. Well, Jews have strong personalities, don't they? Jews are a strong kind of personality people. I don't know how charismatic they are, but some of them are. Like Simon Cowell, I guess, although he doesn't do much for me, but you know, they have the ability to stand out, and they certainly can manipulate people, and they don't mind it. And in fact, emotionally manipulating people is what Jews do. That's what they're taught. That's their religion. If they're not, that's what they're supposed to do to non-Jews, and which is why people like Elie Wiesel was so furious. Because this Jew had done this stuff to other Jews, including himself. And he wouldn't have minded at all if he'd done it only to non-Jews. But he got carried away and he found that the Jews were his best customers, I guess. But the other thing I want to say here, is that, in my opinion, it's not just that, but that people want to believe things. You know, if you try to get people to believe something that is pleasant to them and gives them some kind of benefit, they're going to go out of their way to believe you. You know, so you don't have to always do all that much. And that's where we have to work on ourselves and where we have to get smarter. But it's too bad we have to be surrounded by these crooked Jews and manipulative people that they are. Now, the next thing is B'nai B'rith, a reader of someone over on the White Network in the comments section posted these stories there, and I found them pretty amazing because, and right now, Arthur Topham is dealing very, very heroically with the B'nai B'rith in Canada. He has been for a long time. I want to mention Arthur because he goes as far as he does. He doesn't back down so that he can test out these laws, and test out these organizations like B'nai B'rith and see, where they might be able to be, you know, brought down. And you know, this is what we need. We need people like this. This is what I call heroism. Sometimes you might think, well, he's just reckless and he's asking for it. Well, if you don't ask for it, you're not going to bring it all out in the open. And, that's what he's doing. And this B'nai B'rith, of course, is, I've been talking about Freemasonry connected with the protocols, and B'nai B'rith is one of the major, organizations of Jews, international, and strong, and one of our major enemies. So, but now we find out that their retirement plan, that their pension plan has failed B'nai B'rith, and they have gotten the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, a government agency, United States government agency, to take over paying the pensions for their pensioners, because they've gone bust somehow. Now, how could B'nai B'rith, with all these rich Jews and so on, and really one of the, in with the international Jewry and all the bankers and so on, how could they not have the money? But that's what they're saying. It says, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation that protects retirees from failed pension plans is assuming control of benefits for employees of B'nai B'rith International. International! Not just the United States. What is that? The agency stepped in because B'nai B'rith wouldn't have been able to pay its bills or stay in business unless the plan was terminated. Well, God, what an opportunity that was to terminate their plan and put B'nai B'rith out of business. But no. The government agency comes in and rescues them. As of April 30th, 2011, their pension plan ended. And the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is a part of the U.S. government, will pay all pension benefits earned by the organization's retirees up to the legal limit of $54,000 a year for a 65-year-old. So they have got, it affects 500 current and future retirees, or I say 500 Jews. So 500 of these Jews that are employed by B'nai B'rith, they can afford to pay them as employees, but they can't afford to pay their pension benefits. So they're going to get up to $54,000 a year, for a 65-year-old, I guess once you're 65, as long as you live, you're going to get this $54,000 a year, 500 of them from the federal government. And B'nai B'rith doesn't have to pay it. But they can keep, I don't know, they're still keeping their employees. It doesn't make sense. A B'nai B'rith spokeswoman did not immediately respond to emails. I guess not. It's like the AP. Now, here's another B'nai B'rith story that might have something to do with it, because these are all a bunch of crooks. Dennis Glick, the B'nai B'rith chief, was indicted on tax fraud. Now, this has nothing to do, they say, with B'nai B'rith itself, but this was in last year in March. But he was the president of B'nai B'rith International, the one that couldn't pay its, that can't pay its retirement benefits. He abruptly resigned because he's been indicted on federal charges of tax fraud. And you know, these stories are in the Jewish newspapers. They're not, you don't see them anywhere else, but the Jews write about all, everything about Jews for their own people to know. And he is a, he's held a variety of positions over the years at B'nai B'rith, including treasurer. He was arraigned Thursday and released on $50,000 bail. He was, the indictment. He's charged with falsifying tax returns for a client, a private client of his, you know, in his private law business. Yeah, if convicted, he faces up to 15 years in prison and a fine of $1.25 million. The indictment says that from a grand jury says he was corruptly endeavoring to obstruct and impede the due administration of the Internal Revenue laws and willfully aiding and assisting in the preparation and filing of false federal income tax returns. He falsified information on tax returns for a company called United Professional Plans Incorporated, which administers dental plans for labor union health and welfare funds. The Jews get into all that stuff. He also, falsified tax returns for the company's owner, Jonathan Felix. All right. His lawyer, though, says, we fully expect Mr. Glick to be exonerated at trial. Well, he might be, but you know what? If this guy is the president of the Internet, B'nai B'rith International, he's a well-known Jew and all of that, and the IRS still went after him and worked out this case and have, indicted him and have followed through with it, they must have a pretty good case. I'll bet they have. A good case, but even a good case can be gotten away with, I guess, gotten past if you've got the right connections. It says that Glick lied to law enforcement officials in 2004 and 2005 when they are investigating these returns. Okay. Next is... an article that was also put on the comment section in the White Network by Tanstoffel. Very, very interesting and I think important. It's revealing as to how the Jews are always looking after themselves and using Gentiles' money, using government money to do it as much as they possibly can. And this is something that we don't do. You know, this is about how Jews, this article is about how Jews have special security needs and how they can get their needs met, you know, from their perspective. This was in Jewish Telegraph Agency also. So, you know, they write this from their own perspective, thinking about how special they are, how they need to be protected, and they don't even question that. They don't care about whether other people are protected. They're just busy looking out for themselves. And so this has to do with Europe. And I'm going to start down further down because in the European Jewish communities across the continent recognize that they are all at risk from anti-Semitic attacks. You see, this, when those four people were killed in Toulouse, France, by that Muslim, oh, that was just right. That just got them all in an uproar. Oh, they were in danger. They were at risk from these anti-Semites and they needed help. And they approached all the governments to help protect them and give them special security measures, you know, all the things that they asked for. But also, just recently, when Israel assassinated that top Hamas commander, that also got them all riled up because they think as soon as something like that happens, all these anti-Semite haters are going to come out of the woodwork and come after them. And they're all scared to death. They are really cowardly, scaredy cats. They're just people who expect not to have to face anything unpleasant, that they should be protected, and they don't give a damn about anybody else. They really don't. Now, here's... So they say, you know, that they're in this special... that they are specially vulnerable to the people around them. And they're saying no telling what would ignite the next wave of attacks against our communities, says Moshe Kantor, the president of the European Jewish Congress. You know, there is now a European Jewish Congress. There are always these national Jewish Congresses. But now there's a European Jewish Congress, and they even have a European Jewish Parliament in Brussels. They just keep adding more stuff. And he says, even if it's hostilities between Israel and Iran or in Gaza or that stupid film on Muslims on YouTube, we have to assume it's coming, he's told his fellow Jews at this European Jewish Congress. And let's see. Let me move down here. What are they doing about it? Well, they say approximately half of Europe's Jewish communities have no crisis management plan in place. Ari Zuckerman, Secretary General of the European Jewish Fund, which bankrolls much of the EJC's, the European Jewish Congress's activity, said, at the same time, the spike in anti-Semitic attacks coincides with the recession, which is hampering communities' ability to carry the burden of security costs. So because times are tough, even the Jews don't have enough money and they can't pay for what the kind of security that they need, which is quite extensive in their minds. So they have to look for other ways to get it. And they think the governments of all these nations should help them. And among European Jewish communities, British Jewry is the undisputed security leader. So the British Jews do the best, and we know how well organized they are. They have something called Community Security Trust. And listen to this. In Little Britain, They have five offices. The CST has five offices, dozens of employees, and thousands of volunteers, drawn mainly from Britain's Jewish population of only 250,000. That's half of what France has. Since 2008, this security trust in Britain has installed about 1,000 closed-circuit cameras and digital video recorders in dozens of buildings, and has trained 400 British police officers on hate crimes. So at whose expense? See, they have gotten 1,000 closed-circuit cameras installed in places where they, I don't know, places where they gather or something, and digital video recorders in dozens of buildings, and trained all these police officers on hate crimes. And what hate crimes? Hate crimes against Jews. That's what they've trained them for. And why are the British police officers being trained, you know, to protect Jews? But they are. Now, because, you know, the Jews have, you know, they're everywhere in Britain. The SPCJ, where, I mean, they're so influential. French's Jewish security unit says is a vast network of dedicated volunteers. But particularly in Paris, where Jewish schools and buildings receive robust protection by their own guards and by police. So, you know, the police, the governments assign policemen to protect, to Jewish schools because the Jews scream and yell that they are, you know, they are in danger and they need this protection. Do they do this at regular schools? I don't hear that much about it. Because most people don't do that, don't have this crazy idea of how in danger they are. So it says here that this British CST, which is the Community Security Trust, their budget is $5.8 million last year, just to protect the Jews in Britain, which it raised through donations and government subsidies. See, government subsidies. The government is always subsidizing the Jews. The Jews do part of it. They raise money, but it's only for themselves. But then they get the government to do it too. And their budget is more than double that of Britain's Board of Jewish Deputies, and is far larger than most European Jewish security organs. Irvin Cohn, now we're going to Norway, which says Norway's Jews only spend $87,000 annually on security for themselves. Irvin Cohn, the Norway Jewish community's current president, persuaded the government to make a one-time grant of $1.2 million this year to protect Norwegian Jews. It was half of what Cohn had sought to ensure security at a reasonable level over the next few years, he said. So, the security, in Britain, the security is largely seen as the community's concern, that is, the Jewish community, but other European Jews see it as the government's responsibility. Jew from Oslo, Norway, said, "I pay for Jewish life, not Jewish security." He pays about $200 a year in community membership fees. But he says that the Jewish security is the government's job. The Dutch position in the Netherlands, they have been getting along without any significant help from the government, but to free communities from depending on the threat assessments and budgetary constraints of national governments, the European Jewish Congress has been lobbying European leaders to arrange for security funding from the European Union. French President François Hollande and Czech Prime Minister Peter Nekas have already said they would support the initiative, they told the GTA. So Now here we go. See, they don't want to deal with individual nations now. Well, they do. They want to get what they can, but now they're going to the European Union and say the European Union needs to arrange for security funding for European Jews through the European Jewish Congress. They'll just distribute the money where it's needed. And already this socialist, Hollande, and whoever the Czech prime minister is, said that they would support that. That is just, unbelievable. Now, the responsibility to protect Jews is trying to be put on the European Union. And next will be the Roma. They'll have to give special security protection to the Roma, too. And this is the way we continue to minimize the importance of all people other than the certain people that the Jews, first themselves and then the other people that they designate are important. And we're at the bottom, of course. And these are reasons why we really need to take hold of this. Now, I've got a really good thing here about Jimmy Savile and his connection with Israel and the Jews. You know, Jimmy Savile, the guy who's just been discovered to be one of the biggest pedophiles in history now already. In 1975, there's this picture of him with the Bridge in Britain friends in Tel Aviv. He went to Tel Aviv. And also in the picture is John Levy, who is a part of the Academic Friends of Israel. Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff about the Academic Friends of Israel. They're all Jews. It was started whenever it was started, but they're very active. Yeah, they started because of the academic boycott of Israel and what they considered to be anti-Semitic incidents on university campuses in Britain. And they've been going strong ever since. And it's made up. I looked at all of the people on there today, and they're, some of them you couldn't tell by their name, but when I looked them up, I found they were definitely all Jews, British Jews, and they work tirelessly to promote a good image of Israel and to stomp out any kind of criticism and call everything anti-Semitic if people criticize anything. And they're going at it all the time. Now, but back to Jimmy Savile. He once described himself as the most Jewish Catholic you will ever meet. And he was a strong supporter of Israel. And he raised funds for many charities, Israeli charities, including WESO, Ravenswood, and the British Friends of the Lenido Hospital in Netanya. In any case, well, there's just a lot of stuff here about his trip to Israel and how he filmed some of his BBC shows there. And, this is pretty good. He recalled his advice to the Israelis. He said, "I arrived at this reception. The president came to me and asked how I was enjoying my visit. I said I was very disappointed. The Israelis had won the Six-Day War, but they had given back all the land, including the only oil well in the region, and we're now paying the Egyptians more for oil than if they had bought it from Saudi Arabia." So Savile tells this Israeli head president, "You have forgotten to be Jewish." And the president says, "Would you like to tell my cabinet that?" And the next morning, Savile went to the Knesset, and they interrupted a cabinet meeting, and he told them the same thing that he had told the president. And then this Mr. Levy, who had arranged this John Levy, who had arranged Seville's trips to Israel, said that that Savile had many close Jewish friends. He was a real philo-Semite. Well, he's a philo-Semite and a pedophile. So that goes together, doesn't it? "When we returned, I asked him to be a friend of the trust, and he insisted that I listed him as a special friend. During his visit, He stayed at a kibbutz, and let's see. Well, he went to this, he went to this girl's bat mitzvah. That was, because that's the name of this article. Jimmy Savile came to my bat mitzvah. And he was friends with these Jewish people. Let's see, who is saying this? Mrs. Gruber, this couple, Gruber, a couple of Jews, named Gruber, they invited him to their daughter Sharon's bat mitzvah in 1968. And she said, oh, he was so wonderful. You know, he broadcast one of his shows from there and so on. And this girl, Sharon, who's now grown up, recalled, that he came in a silver suit. Well, that's not too important. But one of his eight homes is in the heart of the Leeds Jewish community in Round Hay. He was a regular at fundraising dinners at synagogues in Leeds and Manchester, particularly for the British Friends of Lanedo, donating large sums to the organization. So that was, now I've got something about some other people. Let's see. All right, I'm going to end up here. Got only a few minutes left. With the Wiesenthal Center likens Chavez's Venezuela to Nazi Germany. But there's a good article about this at in Commentary Magazine by Travis Pantin, P-A-N-T-I-N, Hugo Chavez's Jewish Problem. But as far as the part with, well, let me check my email, see if there's anything here. The part from the, Wiesenthal Center likens Chavez's Venezuela to Nazi Germany. President, there's the Jews in Venezuela are complaining that there's all this anti-Semitism there, and that the countries, that the largest synagogue has been attacked and so on, and they're saying they're, that the people, the Venezuelans who support Chavez are going around chanting anti-Israel slogans, they're going around as mobs, they're burning Israeli flags. Well, they're very angry about what Israel is doing right now, and they act it out, which is good, but these Jews are complaining, and they've got a, there's this long article written by this Travis Pantin, which he says things like, government-owned media outlets have published anti-Semitic tracts with increasing frequency. And he says, pro-Chavez groups have publicly disseminated copies of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion in early 20th century SARS forgery, outlining an alleged worldwide Jewish conspiracy. Well, I didn't get to talk about the Elders of Zion. I just got to that part now. So we'll have to do that another time. Thanks for listening. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.